Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is another Thursday night in beautiful downtown Sherman Oaks, California. Sitting up here in the 36th floor of this high-rise, overlooking the world, Southern California, and the 101 freeway. Okay, this is the Writer's Block on LA Talk Radio you're listening to. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host. In studio tonight, again, with the giggly, charming, vivacious Bobby Jean Bell, my wonderful co-host.
Hey, it was really fun to see you walking tonight without a cane.
I know, no cane. 6 weeks.
Woohoo!
6 weeks post-op.
So we'll be walking from now on up the stairs rather than the elevator. Is that right, Mr. Christina?
No, Mrs. Bell. I told you, as long as there's an operating elevator, you will never see me on stairs. I have to take two flights at work every day, and that's been a challenge. But I'm getting to the point where I can do it really well. Hey, the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley. The good folks at Black Dog are just there to help you new writers who just haven't quite figured out how to negotiate the publishing game. The number there is 805-795-3165. Give them a call if you're new to the writing and see if we can't give you a hand. And by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in New Hall. And they have, like, online, they have some of the finest stuff that you can buy. They have pages upon pages upon pages of stuff.
Thousands, including books and CDs and all kinds
yes,
of stuff.
And they also sponsor the Out West Concert Series, which the last one is coming up on the 17th of this month. Bobby, take it away.
I can't believe it. It's in 2 weeks. It's a little earlier than usual because the fourth week is Thanksgiving. We have Dennis J. coming in from Texas. Dennis has a brand new CD out called Western and Country. It's come out to great acclaim. It's getting a lot of airplay on folk stations and Western stations. When you listen to Dennis, it's like Hank Williams meets Jimmy Rogers meets Marty Robbins, and he has a voice that just leaves me breathless and my knees shaking. And my husband knows that. He's sitting next to me. He knows that.
I was just going
to
say, Jim, did you know that?
And Dennis is just thrilled to be making his first LA appearance, and that is on November 17th, and tickets are available at 661-347-9700. Tell us you heard it on the Writer's Block, and we'll give you a discount.
Yay, yay, yay. And as you know, every week we talk about Target Freight Management and the Target Freight and their truck division. And we do that because they have a truckload service that is the absolute best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload is also the finest and get your freight there every time on time at the rate you need for your transportation costs? So call today, 844-653-7789. Get your pencil out. 844, see, I stole that from Bobby. 653-7789, and you tell them you heard it on the Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you. And while we're at it, if you are an LTL shipper, which is less than truckload, you are probably looking for the best rates with the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket to get your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call or go there today. You definitely will not be disappointed. Tonight's guest is fascinating. And I'm sure that y'all are going to want to talk to him and call and talk to him. So the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. I want you to know I just did that by memory.
Oh, I still have to look it up.
Am I great or what?
You are.
818-602-4929. Now, before we start and bring our guest in tonight, there are a few things that I personally would like to mention. And one of them is a guest we had on a couple weeks back, Caroline Giamanco, who wrote the true story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. Her brother passed away first part of this week, or I guess last weekend, from lung cancer. He was a non-smoker, and he died of lung cancer, and he said, well, God was playing a big joke on him. And I think that's probably right. We do feel for Caroline, and our hearts and our prayers go out to you. I know you're going to be listening tonight because I did get a message from you today. So, Caroline, we are thinking of you. God bless and hope everything works out for you and your family. Also, email me the new address so I can send you yet another mug because I sent the other one to the wrong address. Okay, I'd also like to thank, I have a bunch of people.
I know.
To Chelsea Hickman, who was in our studio last week.
What and a great
I have
show.
To say, what an incredible young lady, woman she is. Not even a young lady, she is a young woman. And she is phenomenal. She is well-versed, well-spoken.
Delightful.
Smart as a whip. Yeah. Delightful. She actually usurped your chair last week.
Yes, she did.
And she just came in here, never been on the radio before, never been had been interviewed before, and had a ball.
Yep. And it's clear in the podcast.
Oh, my
gosh. You were having a great time together.
Oh, we just had a ball.
Yeah.
And I was in theater for a number of years. So it's her writing plays kind of, you know, hit me where I needed. I would live for a lot of years. So thank you again, Chelsea. And when you do that show, please make sure you get me tickets. And in fact, send tickets for all of the Writer's Block, and we'll all come out and see your show in Riverside. Mm-hmm. Okay, then. One more announcement. We got an email a while back, about 2 or 3 weeks, from a listener, John Lenore. And John Lenore is a current listener and a constant listener and loves the Writer's Block. And had a little problem with something that was going on, and we sent him back a message saying that we cannot always govern, nor can we say up front what our guests are going to say and what they're going to talk about. He pays your money, he takes your chances, I guess. So, John, I hope that we explained that to you as well as could be explained, and we certainly do appreciate you listening to our show.
It's so great to hear from. It was great to hear from John and
to hear
from
a
listener. And we would encourage you, if you have thoughts, we're getting ready to program 2017. And, you know, if you've got some friends, if you're a writer yourself, you know of some writers that you'd love to hear from, publishers, literary agents, we would love to hear from you as we put 2017 together. So drop us a line. What email should they use, Jim?
They should use, they should write Jerry Christina at guestwb@yahoo.com, and that will go right to our bookie Jerry, and she will get you set up. Now we're booking already into February, and we haven't called back people from December yet, so we're kind of behind the eight ball here. The show has just taken off on us, and it's really hard to keep up with who wants what and where they want to go. John, if you are a writer, and I believe that you are a screenwriter or at least one for TV shows, please give us a call or give Jerry an email at guestwb@yahoo.com, and she can set you up. And we would love to have you in the
studio. Love to have you on.
And anytime you want to call in, my friend, please feel free. We're here. We always answer the phone, unless I miss it.
Well, we are challenged with that sometimes. Call back.
And one last thing is next week on the 10th, we have a return writer coming from the Bay Area. And he is coming down strictly because he wants to meet Bobby Jean. And I said, well, you know, like I said earlier, you pays your money, you takes your chances.
I'll be here.
His name is Richard Palinelli, and he was a fabulous guest when he was on with Russ and I. And he is really looking forward to coming in. He's got a new series on Sherlock Holmes. And he's got another couple new books. He is also a Jeannie Loicano author, as is our guest
tonight,
I might add. So, that being said, let's move into our guest for this evening. Our guest this evening is he's a judge. He is a judge. His name is Judge Douglas McCullough. He sits in the North Carolina Court of Appeals. Judge McCullough, following service in the U.S. Marine Corps, was a federal prosecutor in Philadelphia before becoming counsel to the Senate Ethics Committee in Washington. He returned to his home state, North Carolina, in 1981 and became the senior assistant United States attorney, where he served until 1996. After 4 years in private practice, he won his first election to the court and was reelected in 2010. And he has written a fabulous, fabulous book. And the name of this book is Jerry. What's your name again? Fred? Irv?
It's called The Sea of Greed.
The Sea of Greed. And it is, well, I'll let you tell, let him tell you.
It's a page turner.
Well, it is a page burner. Judge, are you with us?
Hello.
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 Welcome to the writer's block.
Oh, Jim and Bobby.
We're just dying to hear about how this book came to being, the story behind it, and it's just, I mean, it just keeps going.
I couldn't sleep. I just had to keep reading. So thank you for many sleepless nights.
There you are. Now we go ahead.
It has sex, drugs, and rock and roll, so reading is a great story.
Well,
ever from the time that I was working on it as a prosecutor.
Right.
And it's an untold part of American history.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you want me to tell the audience about the quick plot line on it?
Yes, please
yes,
do.
Yes,
tell as much or as little about the book as you want.
Well, it started on the July the 4th weekend of 1982, and two Coast Guardsmen from our local Coast Guard station in Atlantic Beach, North Carolina, had gone to break up a floating cocktail party. There was some sailboaters who had rafted up, and they were walking from boat to boat and having a big floating cocktail party. They just wanted to make sure they had gone to mooring. And as they did, some boats were coming in, and one of them was a shrimper, commercial fisherman, and they ended up seizing 29,000 pounds of marijuana on board that boat, but they didn't make any arrest. And we investigated a lot, and several years went by, and a guy was shot in Detroit, Michigan, and he lived. The FBI agent went to him and debriefed him, and that unraveled a conspiracy that was far larger than just that one boat with 29,000 pounds. We found that there were a trio, a man from the Grand Canyon, a guy from Detroit, and a high school dropout from Houston, Texas, named Stephen Kalish, who was the head of a cartel that ended up with $50 million in cash in a house in Tampa, Florida. Now, that would be like $500 million today. And they laundered that money into Panama with Noriega's assistance. And it all started from that one simple case right here in eastern North Carolina.
Holy mackerel. Judge, are you on your speakerphone?
Yeah, would you let me
if
go
you
the other
mind,
way?
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, pick up the headset.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
is that better?
Much better.
That's much better,
yes. Yes,
yeah.
It is.
Better connection. Okay.
Now, this was the early 80s. This is actually when even the big cocaine stuff was starting to really hit big, wasn't it?
Yes, this was, the cocaine was kicking in about at the same time, and some of the people, including Kalish, were transiting from marijuana into cocaine.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately for Mr. Kalish, his time as a drug dealer came to an end before the real cocaine cowboys started going on.
Yeah, I mean, you make that very apparent in your book.
This is a fascinating read that you set with great dialogue. I felt like I was, even though I knew it was nonfiction, I knew it was, you know, based on true story, true facts. I felt like I was watching a movie that was just moving at a breathneck pace. And some of your descriptions, the ladies counting the cash, and actually the cash counting machines not being able to keep up with how much money was going through them was just, you know, to me that was just a picture, like that much money that the machines couldn't keep up with it.
My wife is from Las Vegas, so I had to point out that those machines were counting more money than the casinos handled. They really did have naked Cuban women down in Tampa doing the money counting, and there were fellows standing around with shotguns to guard all the money.
But
Kalish would drop by and pick up some money when he needed to go out on the town and party or do whatever. But, you know, having $50 million in a house is kind of dangerous because somebody might want that money.
Other than you.
It's hard to buy loyalty.
Right.
Yeah, and you don't want arson.
Well, I mean, there was at one time, and they said the Medellin cartel was pulling in, just through cocaine, over $21 million a day.
In cocaine.
How do you, I can't even fathom that kind of money.
It's an amazing amount of money. And Kalish solved his problem. He found a Cuban in Miami. I think there's a Jimmy Buffett song by that name, but who was friends with Noriega. Uh-huh. And he says, I've got the solution for you. And they just did it the easy way. They put the money in duffel bags, put it on a private charter plane, flew over to Panama, and took it down to the bank with a military convoy.
Right. It was so interesting that, because I had forgotten a lot about Noriega, that sort of, began to remind me that at the same time that this was going on, he was receiving honors for his efforts to, stop the drug trade the United States. At the same time that this was going on. Do you want to take just a moment and just talk a little bit about the Noriega connection?
Yes, Noriega was an interesting man. The intelligence community said, Noriega is a man who can't be bought, but he can be rented from time to time. And the CIA was paying him rent because they wanted him to be a source on Castro in Cuba. There were some people in the intelligence community who were not happy when I flipped the first non-Hispanic witness to implicate Noriega, who was Stephen Kalish. Uh-huh. And I had a customs agent, a DEA agent, and an FBI agent write up the interview.
Right.
And those interviews went up to their headquarters. So it hit three headquarters simultaneously, and then that went to the National Security Council, and Reagan had to make a decision. And Reagan was just so direct. He said, well, if he's dirty, indict him. And so that's what was done.
Well. Yeah.
In that refreshing.
Yeah. Must have been the 80s.
Yeah.
Now, you talk about, of course, the first boat, which comes into the harbor in North Carolina, but then there's a second shipment that comes into Louisiana.
Yeah.
Well, there's actually a second shipment that came back here into North Carolina with 39,000 pounds. It was successful.
Right.
The guys thought that the Coast Guard can't be that lucky two times in a row.
Yes.
And so they ran another one in. And then they did a big load up the Mississippi, the one you're talking about. That was 600,000 pounds. And they left 20,000 pounds wet in the scuppers of an ocean-going barge. And then they had also flown in about 10 loads of 10,000 to 12,000 pounds each into various parts of the Midwest. So that's how they amassed their $50 million. And one of the persons who was key and central to getting this thing going is a fellow who lives out in your neck of the woods. His name is Doc McGee, and he manages Gene Simmons today, but he managed Bon Jovi and Motley Crue back at the time I prosecuted him.
Yes, there's you throw a few celebrity names in there that he had connections with.
Yeah, he loaned him some startup money, and then the Lee Rich, who was from the Grand Cayman Islands and had the connections to the Colombians for the marijuana, Lee was sort of an international playboy, and he was dating Miss Colombia at one time. He was invited to leave the Grand Caymans and go to Jamaica for the wedding of Tommy Lee and Heather Locklear back in 1984.
That was the beginning of his undoing.
And that was his undoing, yes. We asked the Jamaicans for assistance, and they said, let me get this straight, Mon. All we want to do is arrest a white boy from the Grand Caymans and put him on a plane to New York. And Uncle Sam will be happy. And say, yes, sir. And see, that we can do, Mon. And so he landed, and the Jamaicans did just that. They said, sir, you're persona non grata. So they didn't admit him into the country in a legal fashion. Said, you have to leave on a plane, and he tried to get back on his own plane, and they said, no, not that plane, this plane, and it was one that was going to New York.
Yeah.
So he knew his goose was cooked.
Such a story.
It truly is. And you know, it makes you wonder how many celebrities actually were involved in all of this, because there had to have been more than four or five.
Well, I'm not sure as far as being a participant in the smuggling. Probably only Doc McGee. I don't think Heather Locklear or Tommy Lee were actually involved in the smuggling. They just hobnobbed with Lee Rich, and I'm certain that they probably knew something about his business, although he came from a prominent family in the Grand Caymans. His family owned a hotel on the Seven Mile Beach in on the Grand Cayman Island. Uh-huh. So he was pretty well connected just from who he was.
Well, and I think you mentioned, is it the main, you don't say by name, but the main medical examiner for the state of Maine was connected somehow too, wasn't he or her?
Oh, yeah.
You don't really say.
He was supposedly was one of the customers. Their customers would come to a Detroit warehouse that was owned by a family that was a mob associates, if not mob itself, and Italian mafia type people. And that's where the transactions would take place and the sales would take place. And one of them was like the Secretary of State for the state of Maine. And he would roll in and buy 1,000 pounds or 2,000 pounds of marijuana and go back to Maine and sell it.
The organization behind this group was really astounding. And I would imagine the organization behind all of you going out to get them had to be also astounding.
Yeah, it was one of those cases where everything just fell into place, and when I realized what the whole story was and where it was going and everything, I kept the discovery material so I could keep it fresh in my mind. And it's interesting that you said it read like a movie to you because you could almost see it.
Yeah.
It's because I tried to write a screenplay and realized I didn't know how to do that. And so I just tossed the whole thing aside and decided I would work on it later. And it's one of those things that then sat for years.
Right.
Then I get remarried, and my new wife now, and I are consolidating our households, and she finds the box. And she tells me, she says, "You got to. This is a great story. You've got to tell this story." And I said, I tried. I was trying to write a screenplay. I just don't know how to do it. I'm not technically qualified." She says, "Just take these scenes and make them into chapters." And I said, and the light bulb went off, and that's how the book came about.
Huh. Now, you had a co-writer on this, or actually somebody who collaborated with you.
Yeah, I had a collaborator, but I had the timeline. Each chapter was outlined, and it was merely a matter of us trying to work on the dialogue because we were going to tell it through dialogue and less boring background. I didn't want it to be like a typical true crime story.
Right.
I wanted to be like something that's unfolding as people are talking and acting and moving.
Right. Now, I got a couple questions here for you. And the first one has to do with your dialogue, because I write a lot of dialogue. I'm a novelist, and I think I'm pretty good at dialogue. And I was reading your book, and your dialogue is so smooth and so real, and it's all reproduced from memory. Is that correct?
Well, a lot of it's reproduced from memory because I actually talk to these people, you know?
Right.
And I actually met every single person that's in the book,
uh-huh.
And so I would hear them talk. And also, I had the benefit of certain reports, and in certain instances, I had the reported dialogue, and I just put it right into the book. For instance, when the Coast Guard seized the 29,000 pounds of marijuana, they did have some interaction with the captain of that.
Right.
Oh, yes.
And in their report, they say what he said, and they said what they said.
Right.
So I could take that kind of dialogue and put it right into the book.
And then you have.
But other places, I had to construct the dialogue. I know what they did. I know how they talked, and so we put it together that way.
Right. Now that was when the Coast Guard guys, the one boat docked, and then they talked. They talked to the captain. The boat docked, and everybody took off.
Well, and they hear
it. That's right.
He's looking at the hold. And
right.
They hear. He can hear that there's like
there's
a shotgun underneath.
Guy in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And at this time now, the Coast Guard was so unprofessional that they carried an unloaded weapon in their sidearm, and they had a magazine pouch with two magazines, but the gun itself was unloaded. So when he heard the shotgun rack around, he knew he didn't have a chance. He just had to talk his way off the boat.
Well, that would have
and
been my guess.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
Well, and then you have this character named, his nickname is Shine, and of course he just talks totally differently from everybody else, and he's drunk quite often on the plane. You've got this scene on the plane when he is flying with Ed, but it's not really Ed, it's Simmons. It's a... And he
gets,
he gets, he's telling these horrible jokes, and he's really, he's quite a character. He's sort of the most thug-like of them all, I guess, if one had to just.
Shine was, that was Shine. He was a terrible jokester. He told off-color stories and mixed company from people he didn't know. He drank an awful lot. That's why he, when he was shot, he probably, God saves drunks, I guess. He didn't feel the blow as bad as it was, and he probably looked like he was dead to the fellow who shot him with the shotgun.
Yeah.
But he scrambled over to the phone when the shooter left and called 911. So if you want to get shot and saved, Detroit's probably the best place, because their EMS people must be amazing.
And be near a phone.
Well, and it was interesting to me in this book when you, you know, you kind of imagine a book that's going to be about drug running and Noriega and such, that that firearms would play an important role, and yet we know that Noriega likes to collect them. We learn that. But really, Shine getting shots, the only, you know, these guys are cerebral. I mean, they do all of this organization. There's not a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of brutality or heavy armed, you know, scenes in this book. This is like these guys that are just know how to delegate and create a team and, you know, figure it all out.
Yeah, well, some of the conversations they had in their little hotel rooms were kind of funny.
Yes.
Yeah, they actually were. Now, and you had so many characters in this book. And when I know that you were the prosecutor, and it had to have been crazy for you to try to keep up with everybody. But when you were writing this book, did you keep a menu of who was where and what they were doing?
Well, I knew from the day of, back in the day when I prosecuted the case, I knew who everybody was and what their roles were. So I just, and again, I had the FBI and DEA reports and the Coast Guard reports and everything, so I could keep the players straight.
Uh-huh.
And I had my original indictment, and that, of course, kind of lays out the story, because when you're drafting an indictment for a jury, you're kind of telling the story too. You want the jury to read that indictment and know exactly what was going on by everybody. So the indictment tells a story that the jury will take back into the jury room. Fortunately, in this case, just about everybody pled guilty. Well, I think I had, out of 100 and some people, I had two trials. But, you're right, marijuana smuggling is manpower intensive, because you've got boat captains and crew members and offloaders and drivers and lookouts and
pilots.
All sorts of folks.
Yeah, you're not dealing with small packages of cocaine.
This,
it's 60-80 pound bales of marijuana.
This was amazing. And they were planning a third, I guess, third or fourth shipment that, of course, didn't come to fruition. But they had grandiose plans that were pretty close to happening when the final three were all arrested.
Yeah, Kalish's philosophy was, well, if you're going to smuggle drugs, smuggle big and make a lot of money, because the risk of jail is the same. If you're carrying 50 pounds across the border on your back, you're going to be facing the same statutory penalty you are as if you're going to be putting that 600,000-pound load up the Mississippi River. So go big. And his last one was going to be an actual cargo ship, and they were going to bring it into a harbor in Newark, New Jersey. They had some corrupt customs inspectors they had identified, and they had a union workforce that wouldn't say anything and wouldn't actively participate in unloading, and they already had Teamster drivers from a Pittsburgh local that would drive the trucks. So he was organized and ready to go, and they could bring the ship in at night at Newark, unload it with heavy equipment, and have everything gone by morning.
Yeah.
That was their plan. And he probably could have pulled it off if he'd had a little more time.
Is this still the largest drug ring that's been busted, or is there anybody that's, you know, done anything larger than this that you're aware of?
I'm not aware of any that actually moves more weight at any one time. And there may be some that had a few more people, but there's certainly none that dealt with the head of state. Like the president of Panama.
Right. And that was one thing I was just I was reading a biography of Pablo Escobar, and he had made a comment about Noriega, that Noriega, although Noriega was in the U.S. CIA's pocket, he also was in our pocket, and he would do anything that we asked him to do for money.
And apparently, he definitely was, and Stephen Kalish ingratiated himself with Noriega when he was actually going to move and live in Panama.
Right.
He just had to come back to the United States to clear up a few details. And while he was in Tampa, the FBI was tipped off that he was there, and they looked for him and found him just before he got on a plane and headed back to Panama permanently.
Right.
And and some of Kalish's dealings with Noriega were central to the Escobar relationship.
Right.
Because one of Noriega's officers had busted one of Escobar's labs in Panama where they were making cocaine and arrested some of his people and seized some money. And Escobar was going to kill Noriega if this didn't get straightened out. And Stephen Kalish was central to contacting Noriega and warning him of what was going on and letting Noriega take the actions that he needed to get back in good graces with the Escobars.
Yeah. It's amazing that whole drug thing in the 80s was just, I mean, it was insane. It's like today, a good example is today. Now, there is a referendum on the ballot to legalize marijuana usage in California. And to be honest with you, I believe it will probably pass.
No, I think it probably will too.
And you think back to the 80s where it was, I mean, an ounce or a baggie would get you jail time, and now they're legalizing for usage in a state that probably the biggest user state of all of them. And it just boggles my mind that, you know, only 25 years has passed, and look where we are. We're totally 100%, 180 degrees a dichotomy from where we were.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's a changing time. It's an evolvement of history. You know, you had all the anti-war protesters in the 60s that used pot as kind of part of the protest scene, and they've all grown up and become responsible adults and voters, and then their children and their children's children. Now we've got grandchildren, and all of them have used pot, and they don't think there's all that much that's wrong with it. But one thing that people miss in this legalization is... as I understand it, the legalization is for you to go use it in your home.
Correct.
And most of the police interaction with people who are using pot is when they're out in their cars, they're in other places, they're doing things, or the police are in their home, but for something far more serious. They don't go looking for marijuana unless somebody's a marijuana dealer and they're trying to take them down for that. But a lot of times the police interaction with people in marijuana is just out in the public, and and that, you know, will continue to be illegal, even under the California scheme.
Right.
And in Washington State, it's my understanding that what's happening now is the dealers are cutting the price. You know, the state has a state mandated price that includes the taxes and everything else that they think they're going to reap as a benefit, and the dealers are just cutting the price and selling it on the street cheaper than the state store, and they're still in business. So the idea that you're going to eliminate marijuana traffickers from dealing in that stuff, and everybody's just going to go to a state store like a liquor store. You know, North Carolina, we have, it's called the ABC system, Alcohol Beverage Control.
Right. Yep. They have that in Washington.
Says, we don't like alcohol, but if anybody's going to make money off of it, it's going to be us.
Right. Yeah, Oregon and Washington have the same thing. So.
I'm always curious how an author comes up with that title for the book. Tell us how you determined Sea of Greed for your title.
Yeah, my original working title was North Carolina to Noriega, but that didn't sound all that sexy. And then when I thought about, well, see, this is waterborne smuggling. And my wife and I were just sitting down talking about it. So it was waterborne smuggling, and it was greed that tore this conspiracy apart. When the fellow was shot, he was shot by on the orders of a man who didn't make as much money from a load of pot that he had coming in at the same time that big load was going up the Mississippi River, and he wanted his load to come in first on an airplane, And then the big load come up the Mississippi River, and it was a timing issue, and just like everything else, supply and demand, the price fell a little bit when that 600,000 pounds hit the street. He didn't make as much money as he could have. He made money, but not as much, and he was bitter about that. So he had the person shot who he thought was responsible, and that was Shine. And, of course, Shine lived and became a witness, and the rest is history.
How much room does 600,000 pounds of marijuana take?
It took, if you can picture in your mind, an ocean-going barge.
Uh-huh.
You may have seen barges on the waterway.
Oh, yeah, going up to Alaska from Seattle, sure.
And you will see the ocean-going barges are huge, and that's how much room it took to transport.
Now, they eventually place the monies, the profit, in the banks in Panama, but the drugs, the marijuana is really coming out of Colombia. Is that right?
Yes. At the time, back then, everybody wanted what they called Colombian gold. They thought that was the best marijuana available. And so Colombia was the source for the marijuana. A lot of your California pot today is, I think, grown locally, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, they just did a raid in Santa Clarita, I think, in a house that was like just totally growing marijuana. So it was always a storefront. It was actually a storefront in a shopping center, yeah.
Yeah, they go out in the national forest and grow it. So that they figure the forest
they
will hide
it. From the air.
But the helicopters pick
it
up because it's always a different color.
Yeah,
I've watched that reality show, Wild Justice, which is the California gang.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Game officers.
Right, yeah.
And they stumble across it in national forests and state parks.
Yep.
At kind of remote locations.
Yep. Yep, it happens. When you sat down to write, your wife finds this box, and she pulls it out from underneath the bed, and she goes, okay, you got to do something with this. And you said, I tried. She goes, no. There's no trying
here. Behind a successful man, there's probably a woman who will...
who says, no.
Yes, there always is. You're right.
The grindstone works.
To sit down with all of this paperwork, and it had to have been massive. You had to have box upon box upon box of stuff.
I've got several boxes of material.
How long does it take one guy to sit there and sort through this to even develop a chapter?
Well, I already had the outline, and the story is told linearly, like, you know, my start point is the seizure of the 29,000 pounds,
yes,
in the harbor of Morehead City. So anything you learn about my characters before that seizure comes from their dialogue where they're talking to each other about their past or their background or what led to this or what led to that. And, of course, there's a lot of the story that isn't in the book because I couldn't put everything in.
Sure.
Like, how did Stephen Kalish from Houston, Texas end up in Beaufort, North Carolina?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a whole different story, and it's not really in the book in any great detail.
Uh-huh. Is there anything that didn't make it into the book because it was still confidential?
No, everything I think is pretty well past its confidentiality portion. Shine has died now. He was an alcoholic, as you might have figured from the book, and didn't have the greatest of health, and so he died several years ago. And Lee Rich is back in the Grand Caymans, and they say that he never really got out of the money laundering business, and he engaged in some construction projects, but now he's in poor health. And Stephen Kalish lives in Hawaii, and when he got out of prison, he developed a computer company in Santa Monica that developed the e-card, and so he cashed out and made a good bit of money.
You see,
and but he had an attack of that flesh-eating.
That virus
thing, that flesh-eating virus, and it ate his epiglottis, and he can't eat or drink.
Oh my gosh! Is Denise still with him?
Thanks for your help.
Is Denise?
Denise stayed with him. She got married while he was in prison. She was his fiance. They got married while he was in prison. She stayed with him for 7 or 8 years. And but toward the end, she found somebody else, a San Diego lawyer, and she divorced him.
Okay. I'd love to see a picture of her.
Yeah. Yeah. And her father, of course, was a Secret Service agent. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah. I had a question, which is, so when you began writing, did you, sit down and write a certain number of hours every day, or sort of as the spirit moved you? What was your writing process?
My writing process was probably 3 days, or 3 nights a week. Sit down and try and work out the outline of a chapter from the way what I had written were like scenes and paragraphs describing what the scene would be like, but it wouldn't be, if you're familiar with screenwriting now, since it's been optioned to a movie, I've seen several scripts, and now I have a better idea of what they do. So I only had a few paragraphs, and I thought, well, that's how you do it, but no, that's not how you do it. Mm-hmm. And you have to have the dialogue and everything else in the script for the actors. So, but I had the scenes numbered one by one, so I just would work on one at a time, and then when we had that one good, then I'd go on to the next one.
Well, one thing you did, and I noticed, and I really liked it because it kept your attention, is that you kept your scenes short and very succinct. And when you ended one, it was gone, and you went on to the next. And so that you made you wonder what was going to happen next.
Right, and you titled it with a date and gave it a brief a heading, so we had some idea of who the players were going to be.
Exactly. You never wondered who was coming up next.
Right. Go ahead.
Yes, I did that, and that was because each of the scenes that I had roughed out long before were short, succinct, and to the point, and I wanted the story to kind of go with you and go with the flow. Mm-hmm. So you had the seizure, and then you had the guys wondering about how did that happen, and their post-mortem on it, and then they come back and do it again. Mm-hmm. And then they do and then you build up to, they succeed, they had a big New Year's Eve party in the Grand Caymans, and they tell them about their plans and all that. So each one was, and then the titles came after I had written each chapter. I didn't think about that until the book was in a draft or a manuscript. Mm-hmm. And I said, we could give each title each chapter a title or a theme. And so I went back, and the first chapter was Abandoned Lady, because the name of the ship,
right,
the boat, was the Lady Morissette.
And how did you find, because you're published, you're not independently published, you found a publisher. How did you find Jeannie Laricano and your publisher?
Jeannie Laricano had heard of my book and contacted me and said that she had heard people talking about the book in I guess circles that this was a really interesting read. At that time, she was living down in Florida, and I don't know exactly how she got hold of my book or the story, but she called, and then she moved out to Texas and got married shortly after she started handling me, and she thought that she could get me published, and she has. And in fact, we've just changed publishers, and I've got a new publisher, and it's Argus Publications, and the book is available on Amazon, and December 2nd it will be available on the Barnes & Noble website, and it can be ordered in any bookstore in the country, so you can walk in, and that's a huge deal, because as you're familiar with talking to writers, there's something like 2 million self-published books out there, but I don't know, 65 or 75,000 are in books in print, so...
Mm-hmm. Right. So this show is called The Writer's Block. So, Judge, tell us, have you had writer's block? And if so, how do you work through it? And if you haven't had writer's block, tell us that.
I would think that every writer has a block every now and then. Sometimes you just get tired because the art of writing is mentally taxing. And of course, I have a day job, and my job consists of reading and writing. So sometimes you just need to take a break from that and then come back to it refreshed, is the way the mood hits you again.
Sure.
The desire to tell that story is over. Since I'm telling the true story, the desire to tell people what actually happened, what caused this historical event to take place, has always been a passion of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Since your wife discovered the story in the box, has she been really involved in the editing process, or was she reading chapters as you went along? We want to know about your wife.
Absolutely, my wife is a wonderful person and stimulated me to do this, stayed behind me to do it, and then yes, she read every chapter, and there would be some changes that would be made, and then we'd go back, and I can't tell you how many drafts we went through. So when I see somebody who says he writes 6 books a year, I say, how do you do that? I think they got teams of writers for these. Some of the big name authors have people under contract, as I understand it now.
They don't have a day job either.
Sworn to secrecy.
Absolutely. I have to buy my wife new boxes of red pens all the time because she'll get a chapter of mine and it's full.
So what's your next project?
She writes your stuff, rewrites your stuff, Jim?
She doesn't rewrite it. She edits it. And she's really good at it.
Yeah. Do you have anything, because this is your first book, and you've obviously enjoyed the process. Do you have anything that you're working on, a next project?
I'm beginning to outline a story for my next project. It's probably going to be more fictionalized than the actual story was, because it's going to be... there was an actual female smuggler. You know, it's kind of like a female pirate. There aren't very many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a woman who was involved in a exciting adventure, that this one was completely different. This was hashish smuggled in from Lebanon in roughly the same era. And so I'm going to base it on what they actually did. So it's half true.
Uh-huh.
But and the character will be much like her, but because she was from New York. Radical professors were her parents. Both were college professors. They'd both been anti-war activists and radical, and they didn't see anything wrong with smoking pot because they'd done it all the time. And so she was kind of, and then she was kind of in that Studio 54 scene with kind of wild drug use and. She hung out with Joan Jett, and she was on her way to go skiing when we arrested her.
Wow.
Surprise.
St. Moritz.
That'll be a great read.
And in my story, she's going to have to make that cab and get away.
There you go. Hey, in the time we have left, which is about a minute and a half, let our listeners know where they can reach you. Email, if you would. Website, I know you have one because I was there today. And if you have a Facebook page.
I don't have a Facebook page because of my current occupation, but
sure. The
website is theagreedbook.com, and there is a way for people to email me right there on the website. It'll guide you to the prompt to the email, and they can correspond with me there.
Excellent.
And the books are, like I said, they're available on Amazon or wherever you buy books. You want to walk into a bookstore and order it, it can be done.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Judge, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been a real pleasure and an honor having you on with us tonight.
Well, I have certainly enjoyed talking to both of you.
Well, thank you.
And listening to your show and some of the other things that you're doing on your show, it sounds like you have a ball.
We
and
do.
Get paid for it.
Well, we don't get paid for
no,
it.
No. We do it out of love.
We do.
We do it to provide a platform for the creative folks like you.
Well, when you do something you like, it's not called work.
No, it's
you
not.
Can't believe
It's not. That's right. That's absolutely right. And again, thank you so much for joining us. It's just been a real hoot talking about this book and to actually talk to the person, one of the people, the main people that were involved in the whole thing is just. I'm still blown away.
Well, I'm so pleased that you read it and you liked it because sometimes you don't think that the interviewers have read anything more than maybe the back cover and flipped through the pages a little bit to kind of get a feel for it. But I can tell that you really went through it.
We did.
We read rather than sleep.
You know, and the deal is we host a writer every week, and they all send us books, and we feel it's you know, we have to read a book a week.
Yeah.
And some of them are not real short. Some of them are like 400 or 500 pages.
Yeah.
And Bobby, you know, she's up all night reading, and I go to bed at 8, and I take lunch hours and breaks at my other job, and I read there, so... we get it done, but man, sometimes it's rough. But when you get a book like yours that really grabs you,
it's hard to stop reading. Exactly. You just keep flipping those pages.
That's it. So we thank you for the opportunity to read your book.
Well, I'm glad you did. And I've had people say, I bought your book and gave it to my husband, and he doesn't read a book a year. He read yours in a day and a half.
There you go. And you know what? That's true.
Yep.
It's true. And it's really great because you have pictures in there.
Yeah. And the appendix in the back is great.
All of the additional
information in the back is just as interesting as the book.
Yeah, the whole book is put together.
With Kalish's testimony tells you a lot about him, too. Because number one, tells you the story is true because there's his testimony to the Senate that just basically repeats what you've heard.
Right.
And at the beginning, you see the senators are treating him kind of harsh. They're saying, Mr. Kalish, you were convicted of this, you were convicted of that, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you can just tell that they're looking at him as a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, one of the senators says, Mr. Kalish, is there anything you'd like to tell the youth of America? Can you imagine how charming he was?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he knew how to put together an organization.
Yep. Okay, we have to get out of here. Again, Judge, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very, very, very welcome. And I hope, again, we speak again soon.
And this will be on your website, and I can...
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we'll send you the link as well, so you can post it on your website. But yes, and it'll be iTunes. It'll be on our Facebook page. It'll be on Google...
Google Music.
Music.
Google Play.
Google Play.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Anyway, Google Music.
Okay.
So it'll
sounds
be there.
Right.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you so much.
Keep writing.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was fun.
Judge Douglas McCullough. What a guy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. From North Carolina.
North Carolina.
They call in from all over, Jim.
I know, huh?
Isn't that fun?
And he was the federal prosecutor that took down Noriega.
You know, that was just a fascinating read.
How often do we get a guy like this?
Rare.
Well, yeah. Well... Yeah,
but
we do get them. But
I look forward
crap.
To the next one. If you're still listening, Judge, we're looking forward to the next one.
Yep. And next week again, we have Richard Polinelli, who was a prior guest, and he's got some other stuff he wants to talk with us about. And that's going to be with us tonight, Carolyn. Again, we wish you the very best with your brother's passing, and we hope that that your life is going to be okay. And I know you've moved, and again, please send me your new address so I can get you a new mug.
Keep writing and keep reading.
Yeah, that's right. What did court say? Never
keep
mind.
Keep fighting.
Ah, yeah. Fight on, right
fight
on.
Fight on, okay. Right on.
It's Thursday. We'll see you next Thursday. We are out of here.